KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu. Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks your business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Rob Legato, the visual effects pro who won an Oscar for Titanic and worked with Martin Scorsese a lot. Now he's taken on the 3D challenge with Hugo. Plus, the life story of a forgotten film pioneer, George Méliès. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
You know, John, this past week, The Hollywood Reporter had this big women's power breakfast, and we had a thing about Patty Jenkins, who was supposed to direct Thor 2. And the big deal was that Patty Jenkins was the first woman to direct one of these comic book superhero and Marvel films, you know, and they've got Iron Man and X-Men and all of that. And just as the ink was drying on our story about how fabulous this is for women, she was dropped very abruptly from this project, Thor 2.
Creative differences, I assume?
That's what they said. They said creative differences, but it's hard to figure out what those might have been because as far as I know, they don't fully have a script in place, and I don't know what that was about. But it's interesting. You know, Marvel, as you know, John, they play a certain kind of hardball in Hollywood.
They do, but they also have a history of picking unusual directors to helm their superhero movies. They picked Kenneth Branagh to do the first Thor movie, Jon Favreau, who was not very hot, to do the first Iron Man film, and Patty Jenkins seemed like an interesting pick.
Yeah, she had done Monster, and Charlize Theron had won the Oscar for that, and she had directed the first episode of The Killing, which we've talked about at some length on this show, the series on AMC. So she was an interesting pick, and I think what's also interesting, you know, when I say Marvel has a reputation for playing hardball, you know, they have done things according to their own lights. They have gone to people like Mickey Rourke and Scarlett Johansson and said, how would you like $250,000 to be in our movie? And that is not a number these people are used to hearing. It was negotiated up from there. But, you know, they play a very, very tough game and they don't play by the usual Hollywood rules to the extent that there are any.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I was intrigued enough to ask Chris Hemsworth when I saw him not that long ago what he thought of Patty. And he was excited to make the movie. But now they'll have to find somebody else.
You know, John, very few women direct movies at all in Hollywood. I just reviewed these numbers. 13% of directors who are in the Directors Guild are women. 13%. And I don't think that Marvel either knew or cared about the idea that dumping this woman would be a big deal. In fact, I think a lot of people felt that it was a very discouraging development.
I would agree.
Now, meanwhile, there has been a flap in the TV world over the growing cost of ESPN and people like me who don't watch ESPN and have to pay for it.
Well, ESPN is buying up a lot of programming, a lot of sports programming, and it costs a lot of money. So in the last 5 years, ESPN's spending on content has gone from $3.5 billion to $5.2 billion, which is about 50% in that five-year time period. And somebody has to pay for that, and it's increasingly cable TV subscribers. And the cable TV owners are upset about that. But I have to say, if people want to watch ESPN, they should get used to paying for it. And the reason they want to watch it is because ESPN is paying a lot for good content.
Let me note that the CEO of Liberty Media, which is a cable operator, Greg Maffei, said that the cost of ESPN is a tax on every American household. He said that publicly in the past week. And the problem is the way that cable channels are packaged and sold to people like me, I don't get to opt out of ESPN, and therefore I get stuck paying for it.
I think the remedy, and I think that's a very valid criticism, and I think what's going to happen, Kim, is that there'll be some sort of future programming package where ESPN is its own separate lineup, that you buy a sports package that's only ESPN, and if you want to watch Oprah and don't pay for ESPN, you won't have to.
Yeah, some media executives are really concerned about this because they were sort of scoffing at the idea that people would cut the cord and turn off their pay TV subscriptions. But now they're starting to see that people might be more inclined to do that because they don't want to be strong-armed into paying for channels that they don't care for. So I think this could be even something where the government might take a look. And, you know, just saw the NFL do a very, very rich deal. And that is the kind of the reason why this kind of thing is going on and on.
No, if ESPN is paying the NFL almost $2 billion a year to cover games, everybody's going to have to pay for it, including, unfortunately, people who have no interest in watching sports.
Elsewhere in the media world, we are about to see potentially even more ubiquity for Ryan Seacrest. He is talking to NBC Universal about possibly replacing Matt Lauer when his contract is up, if Matt Lauer, in fact, leaves the Today Show.
There's two things that are going on here. Obviously, the time-space continuum has been interrupted because Ryan Seacrest must have more hours in his day than you and I combined. And also, I think the question is this a negotiating tactic to get Matt Lauer to stay, or is NBC really willing to say, we have absolutely no pretense of having any news in our Today Show, and we're going to go with a entertainment personality instead. In some ways, it's an interesting bargaining tactic, but it's also kind of a sad admission of how news-free these shows have become.
There is some talk, and I should say the Wall Street Journal broke this story, that they might sort of apprentice Ryan Seacrest to Matt Lauer to kind of give him a little journalism cred. You know, the other thing that's a factor here is that Good Morning America does somewhat nip at the heels of the Today Show. The Today Show is still a big moneymaker for NBC, which desperately needs any moneymaker it can find. So if they see the Good Morning America gaining, they may be thinking, what could we do that could broaden this, make it younger, whatever. And that also could be what's going on. And in addition to which, maybe this is, you know, look, Ryan Seacrest is a very important player in the world of Comcast, which owns NBC Universal, owns the E! Channel. Ryan Seacrest is churning out all sorts of reality, Kardashian, this, that, and the other thing. They want to keep him in the family. So if this is something that would be actually a lure to him, then I guess they're going to talk to him about it.
Well, maybe there's a spot for Matt Lauer on American Idol.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Let us know what industry stories you're following on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business. Martin Scorsese's Hugo is about an orphaned boy who lives in a Paris train station. Constantly on the lam from the law, he lives behind the massive face of the clock that looms over the station. A gloomy residence, but one with a sweeping view of the city.
Right after my father died, I'd come up here a lot. I'd imagine the whole world was one big machine. Machines never come with any extra parts, you know. They always come with the exact amount they need. So I figured if the entire world was one big machine, I couldn't be an extra part. I had to be here for some reason.
Hugo is Scorsese's first foray into 3D, and instead of turning to a visual effects supervisor with experience in that medium, he stuck with his trusted collaborator, Rob Legato. Legato has worked on many Scorsese projects, including The Departed, Shutter Island, and The Aviator. And he's had some experience with another Hollywood giant. Legato won an Oscar for his visual effects work on James Cameron's Titanic. And he consulted with Cameron, helping him to figure out how to create the world of Avatar. But it wasn't until Hugo that Legato plunged into 3D. I asked him if he was surprised that Scorsese was even interested in 3D.
Any movie made, including a 3D movie, is of special interest to Marty because he loves the art of movies. In fact, not even the art of making them, the art of seeing them, of enjoying them. So he had personal, one of the great little experiences I had is that we went to New York, myself and Bob Richardson and maybe Dante Ferretti, And we went to a private screening room, our screening room in Manhattan. It was rainy. It was kind of one of those great kind of cozy sort of days. And Marty ran Dial M for Murder, his personal prints that he owns of Dial M for Murder in 3D. So you're seeing one of the great masters.
He has Dial M for Murder in 3D? How is
and
that?
And House of Wax in 3D. His own personal prints that are...
Were those 3D? I know House of
absolutely.
Wax was 3D. I didn't know Dial
and
M for Murder was.
And if you really start to study it, there's like 30 or 40 films. The hardest one we saw was Kiss Me, Kate. That movie.
Oh,
I mean, no one would ever know that Kiss Me, Kate. So Bob Fosse was in it. was in 3D, and so we had to finish the story. We had this kind of lovely moment with him, and where it's like he's like a closet 3D fan. I mean, he owns these movies. I mean, he wouldn't necessarily own, you know, I don't want to ridicule House of Wax. I think, I mean, just as a great movie of all time, interesting, but not. You know, I certainly wouldn't buy it myself if
right.
I were doing it, but. He had it because it was in 3D, and he so enjoyed it when he was a kid. I mean, when you know Marty a little bit, the things that influenced when he was a young man permeate his work. He was very impressionable when he was a young man, seeing movies for the first time and essentially escaping into the world that he now inhabits, really. So he, you know, when he saw a 3D movie, it opened up a whole nother. He would see a 3D movie, even if it was a crappy movie, just to see it.
To see
and,
the 3D.
And so now I never knew that, really. And it makes sense when I think about it now because he likes all movies ever
right.
made. And so it was like, well, I thought we would have to convince him if we wanted to make it in 3D that, you know, against his wish, because now it's going to be a digital acquisition movie to be digitally shot. So he's never done that before. So such a film purist, you think would be, well, that would be really tough sledding to get him to do it. He wanted to do it. He was serious about it. And he didn't just want to do it as, leave me alone, let me do my work, and you guys make it 3D. It's like, I want to be there every second making the 3D choices. I want to make it a 3D movie. I do not want to make a movie that you convert later. I don't want to make a movie that somebody else does the art of literally creating depth for them. You know, and wasn't doing like as a pioneering thing. It was, I think, it's just an art thing.
So when you watch Dial M for Murder and The House of Wax in 3D, what did Scorsese want you to see? What was the point?
That's a hard one to think. I think you start the study process of seeing what was done before and not wanting to necessarily violate what was done before and say, okay, that was crap, and this is now we're going to do something else. So it's just the way he works. You know, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, or my interpretation of the way he works, is he has the movie in mind, and the influences that influenced him, he wants you to see. He doesn't tell you entirely, I want you to see it for this particular thing, and I want to do exactly that. He just shows you, and you have to watch the entire movie for a shot, a scene, a moment, and sometimes the moments are enhanced by his memory of them. And how he felt at the time when he saw them for the first time.
Does he do a narrative during the movie?
No, he just tells you. And some of them you go, oh, this movie is kind of bad.
Kind of bad,
and
yeah.
It's like, the acting's pretty rich. I mean, you do such a great job with actors, and this is like really not that. What are we seeing it for? But you start to get what influenced him now influence you. So when he asks you a question, what if we did something like that? Your brain remembers not necessarily the title of the film, but an image like that. And so now you're kind of on his wavelength. So he's not like a micromanager director.
He's indoctrinating you with this scheme,
and
vision.
I think it's the way he works with actors too. I'm not going to tell you how to act. I hired you for your acting ability and your ability to interpret a part, and I'm going to tell you what feels correct. This feels like this, and maybe you want to pick up your cup. Maybe you don't. I don't know. Whatever you want to do. You know, and he'll sort of indirect to some degree, and that's the way he is with us too, is I don't know. What do you think? Just try it like that. If you don't, it doesn't work, try it like the other way. But he made you think that way, and so you go, well, I'll try it.
It's like the anti-Cameron?
to some degree, yeah. I mean, he's definitely not a micromanager. To him, the end result is all he cares about. How you get there, your business, I don't even need to know. So, and Jim wants to know and wants to engineer it and perfect it, and here's the best way of getting that thing. And Marty doesn't do that. He does, I'm an end result guy.
Is that more fun for you?
It's a lot of fun for me because I like that sort of thing. I like the discovery portion of it, because now once you learn how someone thinks, you don't have to second guess yourself. You don't say, well, this is what Marty would want. It's like, because you now are influenced by the same things, it's what you think works the best. If I'm in this setup and I would put this here, this gets me the feeling right away. But if you told me, put the cup here, put this here, put that here, and I'm left to my own devices, and I look at it and go, well, I don't know if that really does it, you don't really feel empowered to change it that way.
If you're just joining us, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. We're talking with Rob Legato, the visual effects veteran who's worked on everything from Titanic to Avatar to Martin Scorsese's Hugo. Now, when you came into Hugo, did you have a point of view on the 2D versus 3D of it all?
I did. My feeling was... There's a long pause here, so you know. Is that I wasn't sure that drama would play as well in 3D, that I thought that maybe would get in the way a bit.
Right, that's kind of a thing that people say, right? Do you want to see my Dinner with Andre in 3D?
And, you know, the answer is yes, you do. You just don't know you do.
Right.
And so...
I actually believe that, but most people don't.
Oh, I didn't necessarily believe in, you know, and I was experienced with it. I mean, I've seen, you know, Avatar, and I enjoyed it and all the rest of the stuff. And, you know, it was like, you know, do I want to see Raging Bull in 3D? Do I want to see The Godfather in 3D in Chinatown? I mean, I don't know that I would associate 3D with that. And so we started doing the movie, and then it's literally the shift of watching people who've not done it as an art form or doing it as a movie that you'd say, okay, it's an action movie or a kid's movie and the 3D is just more fun to watch. But the content isn't that cinematic, I guess. And it wasn't done cinematically. It was done as a gag.
It would be
fun to see this in here.
Right.
And it doesn't have anything to do with the scene. It has nothing to do with what you're watching. It just has everything to do with you going, wow, that's cool.
Suddenly something floats out.
And as soon as you say, now, wow, that's cool, you're not watching the movie anymore. You're watching something else. So that is your only association to, well, if you do that in a drama, I'm now no longer watching Vito Corleone or Jake LaMotta. I'm watching, you know, the Three Stooges with a hypodermic needle in my eye. But then as soon as we start to shoot it and you go, if you do this tastefully, if you do this with the same artistic judgment call you have on everything else, actors, costumes, sets, lighting, camera movement, all the things, even the subtlety of when do you rack focus from one person to another, all that stuff means something. And all of a sudden, it's like, well, you know, it doesn't get in the way of the drama and actually enhances the drama because now you get to see other nuances that you don't generally see in a 2D movie. And it changes it just changes it. And it's a subtle change. It's not like you get hit over the head. You just get invited in a little more.
But is there a world in which there's a Raging Bull in 3D?
Yes, there is a world. Whether it's going to happen or not, I don't know. I mean, it's a bizarre version
break
of...
news here.
it's a bizarre version of restoring a movie. And, you know, the one part of me says... it would be great to do it, to introduce the movie, because now it's news. There's something new to see in this. And if Marty supervised it and did it the way he would do Hugo, it would be probably really great. So, but this one, I mean, I think it could happen. I have no idea if he would be interested in doing that. It would be interesting to see. I mean, you know, I'm sort of, I believe that you already have that copy. And if you make a new copy, you don't have to destroy the old one.
Right.
You just have the new one. And you could choose to like it or see it or not. And the only thing that I would ever care about is that it's not done as a rip-off 2D conversion. It's done with the filmmaker involved. You know, I'd see The Godfather anytime, but if Francis made a 3D version of it and he put in the same heart and soul he put into the original movie, I'd go see it. I mean, I'd want to go see it. It's interesting. And having seen Hugo done in 3D now as a dramatic film and it working so well on those levels, I don't have any kind of problem with seeing a dramatic film in 3D. And in fact, I think it enhances it. I mean, eventually the glasses and the whole kind of mishigas of 3D will be simplified shooting, simplified everything, and it'll be a more accepted thing. So I think the future is that, and especially if you see sports on TV in 3D, you're just, you know, you can't imagine seeing it any other way.
Coming up after a short break, more from visual effects veteran Rob Legato, plus the fascinating story of forgotten film pioneer George Méliès. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com.
This is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. Thanks so much for listening. If you like this show, you would probably also like KCRW's The Treatment with host Elvis Mitchell, where he has in-depth conversations with people who are making news in the world of pop culture. Check it out in the podcast section of iTunes or on your KCRW smartphone app.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with visual effects veteran Rob Legato. He won an Oscar for his work on Titanic and collaborated with Martin Scorsese on The Departed, The Aviator, and Hugo. I asked him if he can just enjoy a film like a regular person, or whether he finds himself focusing on and maybe critiquing the special effects.
The task of actually making a movie is so hard that you appreciate even just the labor of somebody doing it. But if it's a really bad movie, at some point I get kind of cranky about it. It's like you wasted this valuable opportunity by doing, you know, mediocre work almost on purpose, just by not studying your craft, not by doing it. So I have a little of that. But for the most part, I get intimidated by other people's work. I mean, I see my work and I see flaws and mistakes and problems and things I wish I could do better and embarrassed by moments. And, you know, it's like photographed it wrong. And if I had another minute, you know, all the excuses that you make a zillion times.
Let me just interrupt there. On Titanic, I mean, that was pioneering in terms of the computer stuff, right?
Yeah, but you so know what isn't – you didn't get there yet on, you know, and other people
don't. But when you look at – when you were doing it, did you sort of say, this is going to change the heck out of the world?
No. I mean, I knew that what we were doing as a movie and some of the shots, you know, when you shoot something and it kind of hit a home run, you kind of know it, you know. A couple sort of moments of that is when I went to the set, you sort of get enveloped by the novelty of you're sitting in sacred ground. It got rebuilt for you, but it's sacred ground. It is something that no one else besides the people who lived it actually
right.
see
it's
in person.
It's not the Titanic, but it kind of is the Titanic.
It's the if you look at 360 and you're on that set in the grand ballroom or going down the staircase, you're on the Titanic. You know, it's really like you've transcended the art form a bit. And when I was shooting my stuff and I, you know, we built this tank and the model was 80 feet in the air and I backlit it and I set up this thing. It's like, God, that's awesome looking. That is just, you know, I get to photograph. It's just the coolest thing. It's not like the light is any particular great thing, but what you're photographing is so extraordinary. I did it in Apollo, too. I had the same thing where
Apollo 13.
You light up the rocket and you see it and you kind of get it transcends what you're doing, and now you're seeing the Saturn V rocket in all its glory, and that image is sort of awesome. But that being said, as I'm doing it, all I care about is I don't really embarrass myself and the filmmakers. Because I know I look at what they do is everybody did such a fantastic job and it's up to me to fail. And I literally at every movie I've ever done, like I worked on Apollo 13 and the work was coming out like the work was and I'm very happy with it now and all that stuff. But at the time, it was like I'm just trying not to embarrass myself. And you know, a reporter came in and just started exclaiming over what he saw. It's like, really? I think that's good. Because if you told me it was shit, I would believe that too. If you said, oh my God, it's horrible. What's wrong with you?
Wow.
I would buy that too at that moment of delicate insecurity. And I think anybody who is, you know, good at their craft or wish to be good at their craft, they're very judgmental about what they do. And they're trying to get something that they see in their head that's above what anybody else sees. And no one else sees what's in your head. They only see what you give them.
And the Oscar doesn't change this?
No, it doesn't actually. Not for me anyway, because everything is a new enterprise. Everything is a new deal to do.
You're like, oh, they made a mistake that year. They were wrong.
Well, I hope they make a mistake another year in my favor. I would be very delighted about that.
Rob Legato is the visual effects supervisor on Martin Scorsese's Hugo. And a key character in that film is Papa George, an embittered old man who runs a toy store in the train station where the movie is set. But this character was actually a real person. Georges Méliès was a pioneering French filmmaker who could be described as the James Cameron of his day. But for decades, he had vanished into obscurity. Journalist Ari Carpel has more.
When you sit down to watch Martin Scorsese's Hugo, you think you're about to watch a movie about a boy who lives in a train station in Paris, and you are. But you're also about to watch a seminar on the life and work of a forgotten film pioneer. And it's all based on the award-winning novel The Invention of Hugo Cabret, by Brian Selznick.
Georges Méliès was a magician who discovered cinema almost the minute it was made by the Lumiere brothers and saw the possibility for what that medium could do. He realized it wasn't just something that could record people coming out of a factory or a train coming into a station, but it could record something that felt like dreams.
Someone else Scorsese turned to for source material is Serge Bromberg, a French film historian and producer.
Méliès is a master at imaginary, a master at making people dream, a master at special effects.
Between 1898 and 1914, Melies wrote, directed, and starred in more than 500 movies. Many of them, the first sci-fi movies ever, including his biggest hit, in which a rocket took off from Earth and landed in the eye of the man on the moon.
You know, The Trip to the Moon was the first blockbuster in the history of cinema. At that time, in 1902, it was exactly like Avatar. It was the longest film in the history of cinema, 15 minutes. 15 minutes!
Melies did everything in-house. He even had a team of women who hand-colored his films frame by frame. But soon, technology passed him by. In 1912, his film Conquest of the North Pole was trumped by a real-life explorer's photos of the real North Pole. The once magical special effects of Melies now looked cheesy.
You know, in a way, Melies' cinema was dated. So he was in a terrible financial condition. He made a deal with Pathé.
Pathé, the French film studio that's still making movies today, struck a deal with Melies that they'd finance his films, but if they didn't make money, he had to pay the studio back. It's a deal that would be unheard of today. Sure enough, when Conquest of the North Pole flopped, it left Melies in financial and emotional ruin.
Pathé said to Melies, stop, no more, and because you've lost so much money, now we own your house, where Melies' studio was located, and Melies had to go somewhere else. But of course, everything was in the house, the studio, but also the 500 negatives of every single film he had made in the past.
Devastated, Melies took a rather dramatically cinematic way out, as Brian Selznick explains.
When he lost everything and realized that the audience's tastes had moved beyond him, he burned his sets and costumes and props, as well as many of the negatives of his original film. So for a very long time, much of his work was thought to be lost.
That is, until 1999, when Bromberg came upon the only known surviving original hand-colored copy of the Melies film A Trip to the Moon. It had decomposed into a solid, hockey puck-like mass and was deemed irreparable. But Bromberg was determined to revive it.
We'll see. Maybe it's too late, maybe not. And, you know, it was not too late. It just simply took quite a while to get it back on its feet.
12 years and nearly $1 million later, the restoration is complete. Bromberg premiered it at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year, and it'll be available on DVD next year. It also appears in Scorsese's film, which finds Melies late in life, working in a toy booth in a train station, which is where the real Melies ended up.
Fix it. I know you've been stealing parts from the shop. Might as well use those you haven't stolen yet.
The work of these three men, Martin Scorsese, Brian Selznick, and Serge Bromberg, culminates in Hugo, which has succeeded in bringing Melies back into popular conversation. For Selznick, having his book turned into a movie is its own Hollywood ending.
My grandfather's cousin was David O. Selznick, who made Gone with the Wind and King Kong, and my grandfather and David O. Grew up together, hated each other, never spoke again for the rest of their lives. But I am related. Of course, David O. is from the Hollywood movie-making side of the family, and I'm from the New Jersey dry-cleaning side of the family. But we are related, and I grew up loving seeing my last name on all of these movies. And it's a real thrill for me to think that the name Selznick is going to be back on a movie screen.
For filmmaker and historian Serge Bromberg, having his lovingly restored color version of the Melies masterpiece A Trip to the Moon included in Scorsese's 3D epic seems equally fated.
Well, maybe it's from above. Maybe it's Melies saying, oh, well, you know, he's been 150 years. Now, I want to be remembered. Hey, Marty. Hey, Serge. Do something. And maybe that's what happened.
For The Business, this is Ari Carpel.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to us on demand with our KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.